regarding the fellow's nervous system with that particular question.
Question about feeling and intellection.
Yes.
Wondered if feeling could be associated with the autonomic nervous system and intellection with the cerebrospinal nerves.
In general, yes, you could equate them. There's a question here about the middle one. Let's have a look. You've got two kinds of feelings, liking and disliking. Yet when we are told to examine our feelings, the examples given are, am I feeling pleased, compassionate, self-indulgent, etc. Are these qualifications of like and dislike? And if so, are they not then formalizations? If they are, is it still permissible to use the term feeling rather than idea, form? At what point does feeling become formed? This is a tremendously important question because the creative process of the universe and of art depends on a clear understanding of this. Let's make the equation here, feeling equals field consciousness. This feel here and this feel are exactly the same word originally. The D then here means the limit of the field. If we allow this paper to represent in its whiteness feeling potential, and we extend the paper in imagination infinitely, we would then have an infinite feel that had to be on it. But when we take a field, we have to define the field as finite so far as detection instruments are concerned. So if we take an electrical definition of field, there is a body, and the field is defined as that zone in which the presence of the body can be detected by a sensitive instrument. So obviously this depends on the degree of sensitivity of the instrument. If you have a very insensitive instrument, the field, the D would be written here, we'll say. There's the limit field. And the instrument would have to be moved so close. Supposing this is a magnet and this is a magnetic needle. You'd have to bring it within a certain distance of the magnetized body before the needle would register. If you took it too far away, you would find that you were unable to detect the presence of that magnetic body. But it might be that the needle was suspended on a bearing with a great amount of friction, and therefore couldn't orientate itself to the magnetic body because it was impeded by the friction. If you remove the friction, lessen it, you can move the needle farther out and it will show the response. If you reduce the friction to nil, theoretically, then you can move it an infinite distance and it will still respond. So the D in field actually means the detectable limit, the limit of detection of the magnetic flux which is going up. Now, we said before that every body sending out an impulse wave, an X-pulse wave, has around it six others, Z6, yes, which, as it reaches them, they react onto it and limit it. So that the limiting factor for any given center is always the centers around it. We could cover this paper with dots, let each one represent a vibration center. All the others around it would represent limiting factors, and they would be represented by the D. If you contract a muscle very tightly, with your eyes closed, you can feel the form of your hand. If you begin to relax it, the formal content becomes vague. If you relax it completely and put it down, you can't tell the shape of it. So the relation of feeling to idea is the relation of a non-contracted field, which we would call feeling itself, to a contraction within it. And we're going to see, we might be able to do it actually on a piece of paper. If I take this piece of paper, and I don't alter its proportion at all, but I flex it and bend it back and forwards in a wave form, a long piece of paper, without the fold in the middle, it would be a little more rhythmical. When I do that to it, I'm not altering the amount of paper in it, but I'm flexing it, and in so doing, I'm bringing parts of the paper close together. And those parts are experienced in the feeling as zones of contraction, contraction. Contraction means contraction. So there is an extended field. If we imagine it extended infinitely, the tensions in it to be equal, the feeling is of no thing. No thing, the negation of thing. If I want to make a thing in it, I must cause it to act on itself. Counteraction. The moment I do this with it, this is a typical impulse expulse image. When I pull it in, the tighter I pull it, the clearer becomes the definition of the feeling, and the more it is justified to use the word idea. So if I open it, it becomes vaguer. If I open it completely, it will be an undefinable feeling. If I close it and make it very compacted, it will become a gross material particle. Now let's look at the D again, which always means division. Ye means affirmation. E-A. This letter E, fifth letter in English, in Hebrew, fifth letter is H. This is really a soft H. It's a gentle breathing and symbolizes gentleness. E-A. This is the point. This is the field proper. The D divides the two. Idea. Now, air is an old form of earth or substance. You see it in the word earth. Earth. Earota. This is the field activity. This is the point. I. H. Field. Activity. With the D. Actually, if we put this D here, it spells exactly Yehuda. Judah. And the Judah is precisely the one who divides himself off from the rest of humanity in order to do certain work, to function as a divider and a representative of an idea of separativity, circumscription, circumcision. D is a semicircle. There's the whole thing. There are two D's. Take them out. You used to take them out like this. And that is dead. DD, dead. The thing is divided, disintegrated. We use one of them nowadays, this one, because we write in this direction. It still symbolizes division, and yeah, without D, means the centers in fields activated. And just as we said with this piece of paper, we make a center by simply folding it. This is why we say that the universe is a complex, come with flex folds, with folds. When we fold it, we bring into being, and we circumscribe, and every idea is divided from another idea by the fact of circumscription. So the difference between feeling and idea is the difference between, and this is relative, the difference between the degree of division that you can introduce into it. How sensitive are you? To one man, a thing is an idea, and to another man, the same thing is a vague feeling, because he cannot make himself sensitive enough to find the edge of that field. He thinks that that is a vague feeling. To one man, Art is a feeling, and to another man who knows the meaning of the word art, it is a science. Art is the same as articulation, joining, conjoining things. So, to move feeling into idea, either you must move towards increasing sensitivity, you must make your feeling more sensitive, or you must move towards greater contraction. I put my hand there, and either I feel more carefully to get its shape, and then I can, by extreme sensitivity, feel my hand as warm, and I can actually feel drafts of air between my fingers. Just open your fingers and feel very carefully, and you will feel vortical movement of air between your fingers. Your fingers are warm. They're acting on the air, and the air is spinning between them. You can feel it. And that's increasing your sensitivity. If you don't want to increase your sensitivity, contract your hand as hard as you like, and then instead of becoming feeling sensitive, you have become idea sensitive. You know, as an idea, that your hand is clenched. You are able to feel the form of it without becoming sensitive. So a man may not be aware that you're annoyed with him until your hand close bangs on his eyeball. And then, without increasing the sensitivity of feeling, he becomes aware that you're annoyed. If you can increase your field awareness, you can actually detect that somebody is annoyed with you before they know it. Before they know it, they're not even sensitive to the causes in themselves. And then, if you like, you could release a contra feeling to balance the enmity that was about to spring up. So there are two ways. You can either move towards increased feeling, or you can move towards greater contraction. If you move towards greater contraction, you're becoming a hammer man. And if you move this way, you are becoming what is really meant by sage, sage. The sage is a spiritually active, that's the reference to divinity, earth being. Ge is the Greek for earth. Sage, sage, means the spiritual activity, that's increased sensitivity. Now, in fact, if you increase your sensitivity, you can feel all around your body the air going like this. If you extend that feeling, you can feel everybody in the room to be little heat centers with air spinning round them. If you increase your sensitivity further, you will discover that there are other levels also spinning, electric levels that cause the air to spin and the body to be hot. So there are various levels. When we talk about the feel without the D, we're talking about this infinite sentiency. Sentiency means feeling. When we talk about feel and death, we're talking about a limiting factor upon it, which is always introduced by some contracting element. The limiting factor, lim, is the same as line, the line round it. If you don't enclose it, it opens and becomes exposed to infinity. If you do close it, then it becomes a finited idea. So if you want to move towards idea, you contract, you contract. For instance, if you want to define, that is to turn a feeling into an idea, then find the opposite of it. Suppose we want to define love. Well, we define the opposite is hate. You have to define functionally, in terms of action of the field, what is the difference. We must say, what does a person do under the feeling of love, and what is the opposite of that? What do they do when they hate? We can say love is the feeling which somebody has when they intend to work for the development of the potentialities of a being. Work for the development of the potentialities, the ovary, the egg. Now hate is exactly the opposite. It's when you decide that you are going to pin by power, heart means power, and you will crucify that being and stop it developing. we can make an equation that love is spirit working towards an end, developing successfully, and hate is love deprived of its object by something and determined to immobilize the object that's depriving it. So it is said in the Bible of God, I have loved Jacob and hated Esau. And Jacob means mild man. Jacob means affirmation of the secret mildness. Being mild on purpose, not weak. Mild on purpose, Jacob. And Esau was a hairy man. He rushed about bashing everything he could. And the divinity, who likes lubrication in his engines so that they don't seize up, isn't very fond of hairy men, because they're always spoiling the potential development. So therefore he says, I have loved Jacob, the mild man, and I have hated Esau, the hairy man. And hate simply means his power shall be crucified. T means this crucifixion element. So we must practice these two modes, because by contraction we become aware. When we talk about contraction, we tend to think of a circle getting smaller and smaller. But when we are thinking about it, we are using the intellect, and you will find about your intellect that it cannot work except with a pair of ideas. If you try to think of the whole of that circle with your intellect, you will find you start running around it. The intellect tends to precipitate, to point. So the dot on the I in intellect means that intellection is this point analysis. You measure forms in terms of points. So many points to the line, so many lines to the plane, so on. So, if you look at one side of that circle and put a definition on it, the tendency, if I write hate there, is to run through the centre and write love opposite to it. And the mind jumps about. Actually, I'll draw a circle there and try with your conscious mind, that's an egoic mind, and that's always rational mind. The egoic mind is always pinning itself and then trying to relate. So egoic consciousness and rationality go together. Look at that circle and see if you can see it whole. See whether you can hold all of it without moving your consciousness, or whether your consciousness doesn't tend to pin itself and then run round. Now, is there anybody here that can actually look at it without the mind running round it? The tendency is for the intellect to go like that and pin on it. So if you are egoically conscious as an individual, your mind tends to focus, and then concentration, that means with center, you run around it and say, that is a circle because I started there, went round and came back to the same place. So I know that I've circumscribed the zone as I've returned. Now, the intellect, therefore, is pinning itself to points, and it's always pinning itself, running round, and then jumping across, which is its short way of proving a circle. If it went round like that with blinkers on, suppose we get a horse, put blinkers on, and let that horse run merrily around there with blinkers on, it would not know it had been round a circle. So the intellect, to make sure of it, once it's rapidly gone round, keeps going like this. I'll draw you another circle now. Look at it very, very carefully and see whether your mind doesn't keep going across. Once it's decided it's a circle, once you've decided it's a circle, doesn't your mind keep jumping across? Doesn't it require an effort of will to force the mind back onto that circle and keep going round? See the two ways of determining yourself in blinkers, you go and come back to the same point. How do you know it's the same point? The answer is you jump out of the circle and quickly go like this and say, yes, that is where I've been. So we say there's an essential dichotomy in the intellect. The intellect always cuts itself into two. This is its tendency. the intellect can tell us that by its nature it is dualistic. And it can tell us, therefore, that by building up our percepts, finding out what is similar in them, and building concepts with them, and then building the concepts higher and higher into super concepts until we've got finally a master concept, which is one idea that contains all. There's an idea which contains all the ideas that we can possibly discuss in this or any other universe, because it contains the idea of limitation, circumscription, of activity and passivity, and their relation, the production of a point at the intersection of the active and the passive. This is the observer, this is the observed, this is the active, this is the passive, this is the subject, this is the predicate, and so on. In all universes, this is the superglyph. This is the master concept, and therefore we find this kind of thing built up. There's a globe, the orb that the queen holds. This itself is a glyph of the three-poled man. And while we are on the subject, we can now do a little bit on the planetary significances that we've touched on before. Super concept is this. That represents the concept of limitation. It excludes the infinite and includes the finite. So the circle, which is the vowel O, tells us we have excluded the infinite because we want to talk. And talk is necessarily finite. So now we confine with limits, with end, our attention, a physical tension of force, produces psychological tension. You can't have one without the other. Make a tension of consciousness within this circle, and then begin to consider within any finite situation something is being acted upon, something is acting upon it. Now this superglyph can be cut into two, and we'll cut it like this. There's one, and here's the other one. We've now repeated the diameter, the horizontal, in order to split it for analytical purposes. And we're going to say that this one is going to represent the force which causes creation, and this one is the one that liberates from creation. And then we're going to alter the form of it a little and take this T out here and put it out here. And this one, put it down there. And we're going to make the cursive form of this, because it used to be written very carefully, nicely formed, in this way. And then, to make it quick to write, the cross is put there, and the circle was starting there. And that is Saturn. And this one was made like that. And that is Jupiter. Now, we've said that Saturn is the creative force, and you know that Saturn is equated with the devil. And the devil is, funnily enough, God himself. I'll give you the spelling of it in Hobbes' Leviathan. Devil, which sounds like an Irish devil. Because this is the name of God, and this is the name of God. But it means the creative God. This form, L, is the form Elohim that we see in the Bible is translated as God. When it says God created, it's referring to this L function, because this is the field and this is the work that he did. Field of labours, that means. Div is the same principle of division. D, point, development. So to divide, that working being which divides is a devil. Div is Sanskrit for God. The V is changed into the U, Diu, and into O, the same God, the creative God. William Blake, when he discovered this, said, everyone is worshipping the devil under the name of Jehovah. What he meant to say was creation. is necessarily arcane. Ka. Sikra. To create, you know what we said about the tea is crucifixion. Look at the word eat in there, and you'll see what Gurdjieff meant by the reciprocal feeding of things. To create is to lock, to differentiate, to make food, so that every being vibrating vibrates every other being. Now, food is only vibration. It doesn't do anything else to you. If you put inside yourself a certain amount of food, it merely vibrates your cells and imparts them, life is that motion, imparts them a motion which they were tending to lose. So when you're assimilating food, you're really assimilating motion packets, quanta of motion. So create means to lock up in order to eat. That again is the air, the primary substance. And the creator, in being a locker-upper, is playing the devil with it. Gurdjieff once said, if people knew the exact position of themselves in the universe, they would all commit suicide. And of course, they can't possibly know that. It's a funny kind of saying, because they can't possibly know their exact position until they won't commit suicide. Most people are food unconscious for other beings. There's a hierarchy of beings. And some people are conscious food and don't mind being eaten. When Christ says, except you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you shall not enter the kingdom. He was talking about that. He says exactly this. When you move, you vibrate my tissue. And adding motion to my tissue is feeding me. And if I can get a lot of people to move me, then they're all feeding me. But they won't do that unless I feed them. So I'll have to step up my vibrations, and then theirs will step up, and then there'll be a reciprocal feeding. The Japanese would call that mutual interpenetration of beings. Jiju Muke, the Irani Ranamamiya. Going round and round and round of all motions in a perpetual stimulation of all beings. And that is food. There's a relation between food and faith in the FD function. Because that is food for you in which you have faith, regardless of what it is. This is why, funnily enough, you get fashions in medicines. Medicine is produced, people have faith in it, it acts upon them. Then after a time, the good old chemical combines are producing new ones. And suddenly, as Paul said about the Greeks, they only wanted to know something new. He said a new remedy. When the new remedy comes, the faith is put onto that, and the old remedy begins to fail. Because what is food to you is simply what you respond to, what you assimilate. And what you assimilate depends on yourself. Depends entirely on your own will. You must will to assimilate. Christ says, believing ye shall receive. Ask and believing ye shall receive. If you don't believe, you don't start the motion which is essential to assimilation. A certain substance is given to somebody and you suggest that substance is noxious and then make them swallow it. Then they'll show you some unpleasant symptoms because everything in them is against it. So there's a very close relation between this creation function, the eating in it, the food, the faith, the fidelity and so on. All these roots are very, very closely interwoven. So this function of Saturn, Sat, means being. And the urn of being is the whole universe itself. The macrocosmic sphere is the urn of Sat. If we look in Indian metaphysics, we find Sat, Chit, Ananda means being, consciousness, and uninterrupted motion. They frequently translate Ananda as bliss, it's not the best way of thinking about it, because it's a psychological word which has not been translated into its true function. Ananda literally means a process like a serpent running along, and when it comes to a barrier, it goes through it. This An is a serpent running, and he runs along, he runs along. This is an archaic way of expressing something. Say in Polynesian languages, if you want a man to go away, you don't just say go, because he'd just move about 2 inches. You say go, 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 until he's out of hearing. So in the old days, they say an, continuity principle. That's why the letter N here occurs in the terms ing in English, and the end, the ant in French, German, and so on. The N function means continuous motion. So this is going along, barrier, still going along. So Ananda means this transcendent motion. So as a function, it means this motion that transcends all limitations. So a barrier is put, you flow through it. That's lovely, that's bliss. Of course it is. But you have to understand that bliss is this capacity for going through everything as if it didn't exist, following your will. The function jit is consciousness itself. We see what it is. It is the closing of the field on a point cross situation. Mutual stimulation, the active and the passive, and at the point there is the jit or consciousness. Citta means mind. It is the modern Italian word for city, borrowed round about, and refers to this. This is the city, the mind. Jerusalem is city of peace, shalom, peace. And the mind, made peaceful by understanding this process, is a city with all its streets laid out in logical form, radiating from a master concept, so that when you look at it, you feel at peace because you know where everything is. And you're not bothered at all about anything getting out of control. Sat urn means the urn of being. Sa term. This means spiritual activity turning. The urn of being is simply made by the rotation, the turn of spirit breathing. Sa is this Sanskrit for breathing, spiritual activity. Hamsa, the name of the swan, as the infinite, graceful bird which migrates, it's white, pure, floating on the sea of infinity, is a Hamsa. H, spirit, M, substance, breathing, spiritual activity. And the spiritual activity turning makes the macrocosmos. Saturn, Sat, Urn. And that is equated with the devil, because there is a limiting factor in it. And the other glyph means that which goes the other way to the limitation. So we now represent the limiting function like that, and the contrary function like that. The Saturn is precipitating on a point. The Jupiter is moving away from a point. Point is brought into being by the contra-action from our conceptual sphere, be it ever so far. And the escape from it is represented by Jupiter. And there's a dialectical twist here. Jupiter is Diupita, which means the father, God. Pita, Peta. But there is a joke in it, because this fellow, there's a Sanskrit for your father, ancestor. We just changed the form of the vowel to get the Latin pater there. Diu becomes Jeu, Jupiter. God, the father, is obviously the generator. Now we put them both together and say when the force is going to the perimeter, we shall call it Jupiter, and when the same force is returning to the centre, we shall call it Saturn. So all the centripetal movements are Saturn, and all the centrifugal movements are Jupiter. So there's a movement towards freedom, symbolized by Jupiter, and towards bondage, symbolized by Saturn. Now you know that the planet Saturn has bands around it. It is therefore used to symbolize the principle of bondage. And apart from a few little bodies that are not really to be taken into account because they're difficult to detect, as far as the naked eye is concerned, well-trained and in good trim, Saturn is the outermost planet of the solar system and symbolizes that power which binds. Now Jupiter is a very big and expanding planet and symbolizes this expansive power. And the planetary significances and correspondences are not meaningless. They're not even accidental. There is a real relation, because those planets are in the conditions representing the functions that these symbols stand for. So there is the principle of bondage, circumscription, Saturn. Now Saturn is the generator of time. Chronos Saturn is time. There is no time other than that produced by beings rotating and measuring these rotations against reference points. The fingers of a clock travel round and they come 12 o'clock and 12 again and they keep going round, and while the fingers on the clock are going round, the earth is going round on its axis, and while that's going round, it's traveling round the sun, and while the sun is receiving the attention of the earth, the sun is traveling round another centre. And time is simply the measuring of these rotations against each other. So there is clock time, terrestrial time, solar time, sidereal time. There is a time as big as any rotation you can find, and as small as any rotation you can find. There is time inside the atom, because even an electron has spin on it, it is turning. When science comes to the ultimate gross material particle, he will have a unit of gross material time which he can add up to find out the real relation between subatomic time, terrestrial time, solar, sidereal, and so on. And it's all a simple function of circles added together, which can be struck inside each other with a pair of compasses, quite logically, from a big circle. So Saturn symbolizes all that people in general believe to be bad for them. That is limitation, bondage, imposition, circumscription. They're all bad things. And the expansion is what people imagine is a good thing. But if you keep expanding indefinitely and never contract, you will simply become tremendously vague. These temperaments in people manifest, I'm using temperament in the sense of balance, between too much contraction and too much expansion, there is a happy balance of forces. And this depends on the level of your evolution. And this brings us to the symbol of the Messiah. Where Saturn and Jupiter put together and represented by Mercury. The reason is that the force pressing onto the centre and the force pressing away from the centre produce rotation. So we can again represent this process. I put three in here to stabilise it because two tend to wobble about. And we put that down and say that represents that. Newton, reading this stuff in Roma, formulated his laws of motion. Action, contraction together. Action, reaction produce rotation. Rotation is a product of two motions, a centripetal and centrifugal motion. So this glyph is the glyph of the fellow who can balance the creative force or limiting force and the salvation force. So he's the Son of Man and the Son of God. That the sign of Taurus in the zodiac is made with the sign of the ram and the sign of limiting or circumscribing force. And we just go around that quickly, and that's Taurus. Aries, the ram, is the letter V and symbolizes this expansion from a point infinitely. We have to circumscribe it to make it work. So the top part there means the infinite. This means the whole or macrocosmic, and this means the individuated. So we'll put it in three levels now. The spirit non-circumscribed, spirit first circumscription macrocosmic, the circle, and the cross, the physical body. Spirit, soul, body. And this is the glyph that belongs to the Messiah. Mercury is the Roman version of the Greek Hermes, the Egyptian Tot, and the Hebrew Messiah. He is the man that knows when to squeeze and when to let go. He has two keys, the key of binding, the key of loosing. And he gives these keys to anybody who studies just precisely what is the real meaning of contraction and expansion and what it does for us in terms of self-conscious creation of spirit, which is essentially infinite, but in its infinity makes nothing, but by its circumscription makes a soul, and by the affirmation of experience in the cross produces a body of experience, which body, then folded into the soul, is seen to be portended in the infinite spirit. Infinite spirit contains all these little crosses in their absoluteness. And in that absoluteness, we can't get the relation out at the individual level. So we have to take upon ourselves an individual form, each one of us, which is our physical body. And by means of experience in that body, we can inform the soul and show the soul the potential of spirit. And the three stages will then represent the non-fallen man, and that is why you will see on old astrological charts of the human body this mark of the ram in the forehead. Aries rules the head, that spirit. In the chest is the soul, and down here is the principle of form, sex. The lady or passive, and the gentleman or active. So here is the threefold man again, made into a glyph, and this glyph is the sign of Mercury. And the planet Mercury, symbolized by this, is actually peculiar in its orbit. It's very, very variable. It rushes around, wobbles about, and behaves in a manner similar to a ball of quicksilver when you let it loose on the table top and tap it. It runs about, it'll break into little bits, and they'll all run off on their own. So that it symbolizes this quickness, the mercurial nature. Now Christ is always talking about this, the quick and the dead. The dead are those people who are divided internally against themselves. And the internal opposition between their sub-ends, their parts, out of harmony, in continuous conflict, a house divided against itself, shall not stand. And the quick side of you is a side that can see, which is tremendously alert, what will happen if you allow a certain division to take place. And if it's a bad thing, to inhibit it before it has time to start rolling and become inertic. So this glyph symbolizes exactly the opposite of the word dead. It is the quick. This is the quick man that Gurdjieff talks about. The quick man is the man that understands that in spirit
all that may appear in manifestation already eternally is. But that spirit needs reciprocal centers in order to reflect its own activity back upon itself.
I'm going to draw two triangles to show what goes on. And it's like a Roman 10, doesn't it? It's an hourglass. This represents the level of the Supreme Spirit, and the whole of this triangle represents Spirit, and that is its absoluteness, and beyond here is the Ein Sof of the Hebrews in the Kabbalah. The Kabbalistic Ein means not, and Sof means wisdom, and this not means negate all that is below, ignore it. And when you've ignored it all, then you'll be wise in the most peculiar sense. But you can't ignore it until you know what it is. Ignorant people do not ignore the truth. They are just totally unaware. And down here, the exact opposite of the absolute spirit, is the concept of pure substance. And this concept of pure substance is analyzed into various types of matter, producing an atomic scale. These produce compounds, molecules which build up into various substances which produce bodies, and eventually they produce an individual. The top level of that individual here is the egoic consciousness. Now that egoic consciousness is the point of reciprocal relation between the substantial or mass-inertic aspect of the absolute and the spiritual are pure free. You can't even say state. If you say state, you're talking already about what is bound, a tease in its stocking. Stop is a root stand. Now, we mustn't use the concept there, so we say, this is the purely free. This is the completely bound. Here is the point of reciprocation between the purely free and the completely bound. So we write Saturn down there, and Jupiter there, and here we write our dear little friend Mercury, show who it is. Now, there, at the point of the self, we'll stop using the Latin ego for a moment, because the hard G in it simply proves that the Romans were materialists. They thought, I am a gross material being. That's where actually they lost power. Because I is not a gross material being, it's an observer. And that part of it is the self. We'll spell it like this to remind us what it is. It is a cell in which is resident a force. If we put it self, the cell means salt, which is the principle of contraction, which comes from down here. The highest point of the contracting being is this self. And above it are the horns which point up to infinity. And below it is the cross that belongs to the matter. And this absolute, being infinite, has absolutely no value whatever, because value depends on the significance of the letter V, which symbolizes seeds divided. We can't get value unless we compare. There are no values other than those arising from comparisons. And so the concept of value requires duality. But in infinity there is no duality. And therefore, there is a need for precipitating a principle of duality. And the principle precipitated is the substance, which is then carved up into fundamental matters. And these fundamental matters are added together to make complex molecules, finally organic beings, and ultimately, if we're lucky, reflexive self-conscious beings called human, not just man. Man means a counter, evaluator. Human means spiritually aware counter. At that point, it is possible to direct the whole course of evolution in a different way. All down here is being acted upon by the infinite spirit to make a substance, which is a primary vibration, And then the intersection points of the overlappings of these vibrations become primary entities, very, very fine, finer than ones now known to the physicists. They then add up, they're called, those fine ones are called the tanmatras in the Indian metaphysics, they add up to know it as the gross material elements, which we find in the atomic scale. They add up into molecules, and they build up various compounds until they get an organic being, but it's all being conducted in general without regard for any single individual, except in so far as he is a step nearer reflexive self-consciousness. That means that if there's 20,000 million people on Earth, and two of them are moving towards reflexive self-conscious awareness of their origin, the universal spirit will wipe out the whole lot if necessary to preserve that too. Because it needs these centers of reciprocal relation. Now this is a terrible idea, because it means in fact that most people are disregarded because they are not moving towards reflexive self-consciousness. But it's a marvelous idea, because it says if you can say to yourself, I prefer to become a reciprocal point for the absolute, to reflexive self-conscious being, you know immediately that the infinite will preserve you. It will do everything it can, because you are a center moving towards the ability to reflect back to the absolute and say, you are, I am. You have said I am, and you are, and I am saying I am, and you are. This completes the reciprocal relation between the absolute and the relative. So we can see the tremendous value of the center here, the feeling life. There is your urge, your conation, your physical reactions. Here's your feeling, and here is your thinking. Now there's a low kind of thinking called mechanical thinking, which is simply the reaction of the mind to the stimulation of your five senses. There's another kind that has to do with deliberate dealing with high concepts derived from our primary glyph. Now, these are two different kinds of influence. One from outside, which is entirely mechanical and produces mechanical thoughts and reduces you to the level always of material particles, and the infinite has no regard for those infinite particles except in so far as they subserve the movement towards the creation of reflexive self-conscious being. So we have to be aware that it is in here, in the feeling, that we can solve the relation between the bound relative and the infinite, the absolute. Here then, in the feeling zone in the soul, it is possible to judge a relation between a particular sense datum and an absolute idea in Plato's sense. The man who, instead of reacting to an idea, we must do a fallen man now. Otherwise, I don't understand what we're talking about. I'm going to draw a man like this. That is the inversion of this. This is the Egyptian hieroglyph for the letter H. It is the eighth letter. H and eight are the same word. This one has got his tails, his three horns, below, and this one above. Now you know that St. Peter was crucified upside down for certain symbolic reason. Here is the reason. This is a cord twisted three times, the thrice twisted cord of Hermes with Mercury, who is the Messiah. This symbolizes the threefold man and his infinite origin. This one says that this man knows that he comes from a spiritual source, and this one says that the man is driven by sexual urges. These things go down in that diagram Prophet's door, this fellow here. And same in this one. So that's two men there. One rooted in matter, and the other rooted in spirit. Now the man that reacts always to the sex stimulus is being acted upon genetically. That is to say, there's only a general action on him, there's no care for him as an individual. He's merely a doorway to a seed which might be a reflexive self-conscious being in another generation. So all the men that respond to the stimulus that comes here are stressed down here. A stimulus comes, a seed is made, and the seed comes out again and has another try. If we get hit hard enough and often enough, the vibrations of the blows we receive produce form. There's a beam, there's a stimulus. There's the form inside, the reaction. If we get hit hard enough and often enough, our form becomes quite complex. And eventually we discover we've got all the form of infinity in us. And then we say, all right, now I'm not going to react to that level, I'm going to start being considerate. This is an immediate reaction. This one says, let me feel very carefully whether I like what's going to happen to me. Let's call this one a one brain being. Stimulus, reaction. Here's a two brain being, go up, and you feel whether you like it before you let it out. And then, when you've felt and become very, very sensitive, you become aware of a type of situation. And types belong up here. After a certain number of repetitions, you say, oh yes, now I know why the Brahmin priest is not allowed to marry a red-headed woman. They're hard to control. So, you go up there and you write up there, red-headed women are not for priests to marry. Up here, you write all the principles. And those principles are eternally in spirit. And so you're gradually becoming aware. And as you become aware of these principles, you are transcending. But at the level of evolution of man who's trying to evolve today, he can't jump into that immediately. He can only do it by telling himself honestly whether he likes or dislikes a given stimulus. He must be honest. He must tell himself, without any ambiguity, without any fluff, exactly as Christ required him to do. You must say yes, and you must say no. All else comes of the devil. If he won't make his mind up between yes and no about any given thing, he'll fluff about. And in so doing, he'll begin to disintegrate. Now the rule is that to every properly formulated question, the answer is either yes or no. So if you can't get the answer yes or no, you haven't formulated your question properly. In order to do it, you must break the situation down quite a lot. There's a little thing here. This question of feelings of two orders, like in this life. Am I feeling pleased, compassionate, self-indulgent, etc.? How do we line those up with liking in this life? We have to analyze them. Now, if you feel very, very lazy and don't want to work on yourself and would like the results of somebody else's work, you can read Spinoza's analysis of all these things. He worked it out quite well. How simple liking, a feeling, plus a certain idea and the situation added together equals compassion. How many elements are there? There is a feeling in compassion and with and suffering, isn't it? With suffering. Somebody is suffering, I am with them in my feeling. That is compassion. So here is one fellow, here's another fellow. This fellow is on the cross, this fellow isn't. And this fellow looks at that fellow, and the vibrations of this man are going out like this. And if you're very sensitive, you can feel the cross in yourself that really is centered in that man. If you then say, all right, I expose myself to this feeling. And then I say, what would I do if I were in that position? What would I like done to me in that position? And then you proceed to do it. And your compassion becomes effectual. So it's still liking. I like to do something for that man because he's in a position which, when I feel it in myself, I would dislike. So we can then cut the thing down and always find like and dislike. No matter how complex the situation, we will always find a relation in it that will break down and tell us exactly what it is, and then we can give to each part of it, on analysis, a simple yes and a simple no. I wouldn't like to be crucified like him who is the shadow of it. I wouldn't like it to get more intense. Already it upsets me, and I'm not actually in the position. The mere idea that I might be in the position makes me shrink. I would not like to be in that position. And because I know, or at a lower level simply believe, that the whole universe is somehow related together, and if I refuse to help him, at some point in the future it might happen to me, and if it happens to me and I refuse to help him, I'm not logically justified in expecting somebody to help me. Therefore, I must give an unqualified yes to aiding him, because I give an unqualified no to myself not being aided in the same situation. Now, if you persist in that kind of analysis with the most complicated feelings, you'll find you've still only got two feelings, plus an idea situation. Break down the situation, look at it, analyze the functional relationship between the entities in it, and you can then cut it down to liking and disliking. And if you remember the supreme represented by the Aries sign, or a V on the top of the Mercury figure, symbolizes a non-dual. This is going to infinity, and in infinity there is no difference whatever between any of us. And that same infinity, that non-differentiation, the Advaita, the non-dual analysis of Shankara, is dealing with this. The same infinity precipitates the finite in particular, a series of such, all precipitated from the same infinity, and it is trying to lift them up to the level where they're aware of it. But because the supreme value to the infinite is beings that are aware of it, it by its nature cannot have regard for them as individuals if they are struggling away from that person. Not that it arbitrarily interferes with them to punish them. It doesn't. They punish themselves by running away from it. I'm going to do another version of this diagram. Let the center represent a seed. Let this represent a limit at a given evolutionary period of time. Let this represent a direction. This seed, SD, spirit dividing, this seed, this sama, English word same, Sanskrit sama, seed, spirit substantiating, spirit dividing. When a seed exists, there are forces in it trying to differentiate. And to differentiate is to make differences. So a man is very busy making sperm, and they're all different. So that if he has 10,000 children, they're all different. Being different, they will be functionally adapted to different environments in different ways. And consequently, when the seed is differentiating, some of that seed's differentiated parts will point in this direction. They'll all split out. If you keep on having your children, you'll find they're all different. And they'll all go on differentiating. And out of all those directions, only one of them is going back to the absolute. And half of them are going away from it. Now let's call this the line that evolves towards non-dual consciousness. And we can see immediately from the nature of the seed differentiating produces human beings that are moving in all different directions. And yet, the supreme value to the infinite is to gain some reciprocal centers and become aware of it. So only this line is important individually to the infinite. So along this line is the line of the Messiah. There's Abraham. That is the Father who is the differentiating power of the substance, Abraham. The Father, Ab, the Son, Ra, the Ghost, Ham, Abraham. Along that line, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and so on, up here, David, and eventually the Messiah, who is the perfect, reflexively self-conscious being, the type that we have to become, and yet all the beings on earth are differentiating, which means literally that millions of people are not going along that line from the inherent differences of the egg. Now, next to it are the kings of the world who are not going towards the non-dual, but they don't want to go down here into slavery. So they go towards monism. This is non-dual world here. I and my Father are one, says Christ, and you will be one with each other, and as I am one with you, and we are one in him. It's a non-dual statement. The next thing to it is monism. There's another monism over here. We'll call this a spiritual monism, and that's a material monism. Both are hierarchical. One gives rise to the church with all its authority, the Pope on the top, a terrestrial figure, and the other gives rise to Marxism, a hierarchy of material powers. They are power pursuers. They are monists. They believe in a hierarchy. But they put the top brick on the pyramid, and they never wanted it. Special way, like sheep to clip the wool. And that process of caring is always tending towards differentiation, because it's not going towards the non-dual, absolute relation. If we go down here into the opposite of this non-dualism, the perfect dualism of the opposition between matter and spirit. Those people believe that spirit is one thing and matter is another. We can place all around here various processes which work out into different philosophies. This would tie up with another diagram we did a year ago or so. And you could then build your philosophical systems in it. At the moment, the essential thing is to realize that either you are on that line or not, biologically. That is, there is a seed tendency in you, or not, to want to deal with every being absolutely instead of relatively. That is to say, there is no difference whatever between myself and yourselves. There aren't selves. There isn't even self. It's super self. And all these little bodies are precipitates within it, and they all have to be treated in exactly the same way. There can be no taking advantage of anybody whatever if you're on that line. And if you have any tendency in you to wish to get power in order to take advantage of any other beings, that tendency doesn't belong on that line. That looks very much as if we're moving towards Calvinism, if we're not careful, or towards the chosen people concept. But we are saved from this by a fundamental fact. Spirit is not made of discrete parts. It is absolutely continuous, and therefore it is in no sense to be separated. So if there is any spirit in you at all, and there must be, otherwise you cannot subsist, then it follows that you have all these tendencies in you. And therefore there is in every being a line which, if developed, will lead to the non-dual consciousness. But unfortunately, we will now represent this middle line. Unfortunately, everybody below this line is suffering from mass inertia and doesn't understand that there is such a possibility. And everybody above that line, except this particular direction, believes in authority over the masses. So they're sick because they have no order. And they'll have to be taken care of. So we set up a monistic view. We will deliberately teach that a God exists, resides on the sparrow, and I know he watches me, and I am his representative. $2, please. This process goes on with the Marxists on the one side and the right-wing churchy hierarchies on the other. They believe in spirit because they know they've got something that these people haven't got. They don't want to make the final step to say that that matter is only a mode of operation of spirit. And so even those perfectly stupid beings are spiritual beings veiled by inertia. Now the chemistry of all parts of space is the same, and spirit is not differentiated. Therefore, we are all of us, each one of us, centres of absoluteness, and all our differences are the product of stimulations which have given rise in us to sub-ents, to subsidiary entities which are represented by these lines, which means that we have a sub-ent that's going to God, only he's a super sub-ent, and we have some other sub-ents that are very, very ready to be helpful and push everybody about and keep them in order. And we have a lot of others to say, oh, what the hell, I'm going to bed now.
That's a cue for me to go.
No. So, let every one of these lines represent a sub-ent tendency. And we will find that we have a certain sub-ent in us which actually contemplates this non-dual, this absolute preparedness to treat every being as if it were the precipitate of the one being that this sub-ent knows it is. Then you have a concept in you, a conceptual being that is a non-dualist, the highest metaphysic ever produced, considered by the Indian priest too high to give to the masses, because the masses are too low to receive it. And you cannot bring it down. You cannot go to a football crowd and start talking to them about the Advaita Vaishnava Shankara. They just won't know what you're talking about. It takes quite a lot of work before you can understand what non-dualism means as opposed to monism. In monism, you have a concept which requires circumscription. Call it God. Well, that's God. And there is the archbishop. And there is the king. There's a little difference of opinion between the king and the archbishop about which one is on the side nearest to the power of God. So they have a little agreement called the divine right of kings by the grace of archbishops. And then inside here, nations and peoples and so on. And so they say, you obey the king because God has said through Paul, be ye subject to the powers that be. And they're monists. They like God to exist because, as Kant said, they positivist, even if religion doesn't exist as a truth, it ought to exist as a social necessity for unity. If God doesn't exist, we will have to invent him because people need him. That's that God. That's monism. The Advaitist says, all right, that's God. He exists. Yes, there is a macrocosmos. There's a macrocosmic limit. Rub it out. They are not interested. That's spirit, that's spirit, 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 spirit. All is spirit, and all bodies, all universes are functions of spirit, and nothing else. And we prefer to consider everybody as a function of spirit, because we feel better that way. Because then we are relating ourselves all the time to ourselves. If you can get that response out of a person, that means that they are one with you in the idea and the understanding. You feel better than if you don't. So the Advaita says, all right, we will get this. We will ignore all forms as valid in their own right
consider them as functional modalities of spirit, and it is the spirit we're interested in. You can have your God, you can have your divine king with archbishop blessing, and you can have your subject masses, but we assert that they're all modal operations of a hierarchical system set up by the infinite for its own purpose of producing reciprocal centers to become self-aware at both ends, that is, absolutely and relatively. The rabbis say infinity at both ends, and it's a good image, because if there is the earth, you can move towards the earth that way, center, but you can also move away from it like that, and you can move away from it infinitely. So here's one end, and there's the other end. Because if you move away infinitely, you should be able, at infinity, to move back to the earth infinitely. So the rabbis say infinity both ends. So in the same way, non-dualistically, we say, that body of my dear friend Ken, and this body, and all the other bodies in the room, are simply little vibrations in the absolute. And to pretend that one set of vibrations is more valuable than the others is confusion. Because in realistic fact, if you gave Ken a smack with a steam hammer, such as to disperse the motions of his body, so that he would no longer be recognizable, you could not have destroyed one tiniest bit of the motion which had been compounded as Ken. And consequently, Ken would have been dispersed, and he would be still vibrating in the absolute, and those vibrations must go to a term, and they must come back unto the gentleman wielding the hammer. That is a law. Every impulse goes to a limit and comes back. This is the doctrine of karma. That a desire, release, differentiates itself, goes to the term, and returns to the point of initiation. This has to be accepted as a necessity of a universe at all. A one term, a universe. So here, this diagram, which is the 270 jarring sects computed by the vine, as Zomar has it, is 270 because it's the signs of the zodiac split in a certain way. You get 6 and 12 and function them together and you get 72 jarring sects. There are also 72 jarring sevenths in your body because man is a microcosm, he's a universe in little. There is nothing outside man that is not in him. And if there were, it would be a waste of time, because we couldn't know about it. So, we look at this diagram, and in order to evolve quickly, we must say to ourselves, at any given moment of the day, I have an impulse in me. Is it an impulse that is based on my non-dual concept? That what I am doing is myself to me. That there are no other selves, plural. There are only other bodies in the self. So if I gain reflexive self-conscious awareness and Ken gains it, we won't have two selves talking to each other at the top. We'll simply be aware down below that we're absolutely one above. We keep our duality of body because that's the basis of value relation, to keep the duality of body. But we know that at the top level we are identical, not just two chummy souls. So we test ourselves in any given situation by saying, is this a non-dual servant speaking or not? Now, most times when we listen, we'll find it isn't. We'll find down here there's a gentleman called, what's he called? Pally. He's always been Pally for the wrong reason, this fellow. He is always splitting. He likes to posit seeds of power all over the place. And he has no regard whatever for the recipient. He's just getting rid. He doesn't want a personal relation at all. As a matter of fact, concrete examples exist of this in Ritz's in various towns, where a certain type of young man goes at 11 o'clock when it's about to stop. He doesn't go for the evening's dancing. He goes at 11 o'clock when it's letting out time. And he watches the girls to see which girls are in what moods
and I was taken home. And he actually says, and I didn't even have to pay for it. To go in. This is this kind of fellow. He exists. He's part of the process.
In Pope's essay on Mancy, whatever he is right at its own level. He's doing something. He's fulfilling a long-felt want at a certain level. And there is a servant in every man that would do that kind deed very often, as long as it had the strength, and even sometimes when it hasn't. And that servant has to be recognized as the exact opposite of the servant. This one is positing dualities all over the place. We have to learn to recognize every servant we've got, and we can only do so with our test one, which is the one we want. The nearest thing we will get to it for some time is a very high, monistic fellow who believes in non-dualism as an idea for tomorrow. Meanwhile, we are getting on with the acquisition of power and helping these unfortunates down here to be put safely in jail for their own good, and so on. When we find that we're getting egoistic power impulses, we know that we are not very far off the non-dual concept, because we are beginning to affirm a monistic analysis, a hierarchy with ourselves as king, self-less by self-priest, and we will establish a hierarchy. We know then we're being monistic, and we know then that all we've got to do is rub out that boundary and affirm exactly the same for every other being to just affirm for ourselves. The tools will set up a hierarchy in which I shall be sheep and my wool shall be good. In fact, I must sell him a pair of scissors to cut my hoof forward. This kind of reciprocal relation brings us nearer and nearer to this non-dual analysis. This is the one that Christ is on. This is the one that the best servant in its real sense is on. Good. Good. The animal's almost very nice. Better. And best. And then there are three stages. Now, good belongs to the gulit, this department. Better in the house of law, best Torah, and best belongs in here. That's the feeling that S is pure being. And that being is this feeling awareness which embraces this. This is a diagram of the fallen man who thinks there, has urges there, but can be saved by refining his feeling to examine his ideas in the light of this non-dual process. So the good is there, that you deny. The better is a good idea. The best is simply to be in feeling sensitive to the whole process. Then we come back to this necessity for feeling, and that feeling contractions create ideas. That an expanded idea will give rise to a feeling. That if you analyze very carefully all the ideas you've got and all the complex feelings, they will come down to very, very simple forms of liking and disliking. Yes, the question belongs to all. Let's have a look at a few bodies now. Here is a body which simply absorbs food. That's the belly body. Here is a body which is aware of liking and disliking food. And here is another body which thinks about the kind of food that it likes and dislikes. That's a three-bodied being. Now, remember that matter is simply a modal operation of spirit, and then that is a three-brained being. Brain is house, ruling activity in Bahrain, the house of ruling activity in. So here in the head You have a special brain, thinking and collating all the processes here. Here, in here you have another brain, and down here you have another brain. Those are three brains of ruling centers. Now, theosophists and others, various systems, have complicated this and produced weird and wonderful assortments of bodies. We're going to make it very, very simple and then see how the differences arise from the simple version. This one is concerned with the gross assimilation of food. This one is concerned with the subtle idea. This one is concerned with the causal, which is feeling. Which is very funny, because we always get this causal one coming in the middle. Because the field, which of the D was a limit, starts from a center, spreads out to a limit. Its limit is determined by the center. Really, it goes through, and all these processes are in a superfield which extends infinitely. The control factor comes from this center, because we won't think unless we feel like thinking. We won't eat our din-dins unless we feel like eating them. And so it is in this feeling process that the cause of our actions rises. So the causal body is the feeling body. The subtle body is the idea body. And the gross is your actual material body, which you get by dropping particles of external terrestrial matter down a hole in your face, whereupon they are digested or cut into bits, altered a little, put into fluids, raised up, and made to circulate. And after they've gone up and down a bit, they collect at the bottom in little seeds here for future performances. Now, because the gross body and the subtle body are what they are, to link them you must have feeling. But the gross level is entirely urgeful. The psychologists would call that conation. That con is once a rude word. It means rushing into holes, this urge. It's almost running into cul-de-sacs. And it's never negative. It's a funny thing about this energy. It is either asleep, or if it wakes up, it is always positive. It never says no. This energy, this sexual drive, either sees the thing is worth going at, or it goes to sleep. It can't wake up and be bothered to say no. If it wakes up, it has said yes. So that's an entire positive urge down there. And the opposite of it is a pure negative. And the Buddha said that the brain, the mind, is the organ of fear. This urge drives you into situations of roughly that shape. And the urge dashes in and bangs up there. And finds it can't get through and then retires for the first try. When it finally gets fed up with the results, the reverberations here have produced subtle changes called ideas, which are up there, and they are recorded as things that won't work, things you can't get away with. So the brain is full of wonderful things that you can't get away with, that you've tried, so it's a negation function. And in the middle here is the pulse name, the yes and the no, and the feeling. But these differences were potential in the field. So the field is the causal one, which has, by feeling awareness, mobilized itself as urge. Will is mobilized feeling. We use the word will when we talk about the point of initiation. And the field, which is balance, suddenly mobilizes itself. At the point of mobilization, it is called will. So the field, which is balanced in a certain way, disturbs its balance in order to create. That produces this urge. The urge rushes into experience. The reaction of the environment produces thought. So there is the cause. Now, between this feeling and this urge, there is the creation of another body. There's your navel. Below the navel are certain functions. Above the navel and up to the solar plexus there, say up to the diaphragm roughly, there are functions. The Greeks call this the epitome here. This is the red dragon. You'll notice that between the navel and there, there's a certain function to do with anger. If you feel very carefully, when you're annoyed, you'll feel a process going on between the navel and the solar plexus. This is this brain here. And the top part of the urge is becoming aware of itself. The bottom part of the urge just is unconscious. It just rushes. It has no idea of pleasures or pains. It can actually rush at a wall with its head and bang its head repeatedly. And it has no pleasures and pains. If an ordinary person goes into this state and he's examined by a doctor, he will be assumed to be a pathological case, because ordinary people respond with pains in such situations. But this lower element of the drive doesn't, it just goes at it. It keeps going at it in order to get sensitivity. So if ever you find a person banging his head against the wall, don't be sorry for him, because it's his method of learning how to become sensitive. It means he's reached the pitch where his only way to sensitivity is to beat his head on the wall. That's the level at which he stands, and at that point, if you substitute for the brick wall a padded wall, you'll hit harder and harder and harder, and you'll have to make the pad softer and softer and softer. And it's really a fight between your concept and his. Now, the lower feeling here is concerned with this urge, and the higher feeling is concerned with the lower idea. So we have here another brain, and this one we'll say is situated with the larynx as a centre. You know how tremendously emotional the larynx is. You can see all sorts of funny activities going on, and the thyroid gland, how closely linked to the emotional life it is. But it is the emotional life linked to the ideas, as opposed to the emotions linked to the urge. We've now got a five brain being. And the average man doesn't know that he has five brains. He doesn't even know he's got three brains. And a good intellectualist thinks he's got three brains and thinks he's got the top when he's an intellectual. And really, it's quite a low order compared with the kind of activity that can go on in here and here. And even those are low compared with the activities that go on above there and below there. This individuated urge, which is unconscious, is a particularization of the substantial urge, primary precipitation of the infinite. And the opposite end of it, the idea, individuated, particularized, the individual idea, is the lower part, the absolute idea. So now we've got seven brains. To climb from one to the other, you have to become aware. Everybody starts like a baby. They rush at the situation and get knocked. That knocking causes reverberations up to his conscious limit. It writes things in his brain substance, and then the reciprocal relation between I want and thou canst not have, as Daddy says, produces feelings in the child of I love my din-din, I hate my daddy, and so on. On the other hand, I love my daddy on a Saturday because I get a penny, and I hate him the rest of the week because he gives me nothing. A psychologist would be aware of this ambivalence in the child. The child always loves everybody who gives him his own way, and he hates everybody else. And this is the level of the gross reaction producing the most rudimentary thought. And the feeling analysis of the child is such, the child grows with his wants and the negations of his wants. So if we can become aware here of the feeling about the urges, we're learning about another brain that we don't usually know about. By brain I'm talking about a zone, a house of a ruling activity internally. And these centers actually have vibrations here, very peculiar ones, which are not quite like the gross ones, not quite like the conscious feelings of the individual, but they allow you to feel what your urge is trying to do. And the same way here, the feeling about what your ideas are trying to do puts you into these centers. And the idea individuated related to the absolute idea puts you into this center. From the top of your head is a pointless asked of the thousand question lotus. That is the one point at which the individuated idea becomes related to the absolute. Right down here at the lowest sexual level is the part of yourself that is receiving universal substantial impulses which don't even become pleasurable or painful. The physical sex act itself is so interwoven with pleasure pain that they cannot be sorted out at that level. The intensity of the pleasure and the pain is identical, and it cannot be sorted out. That belongs to the lowest part, because the substantial urge is coming in and enjoying itself, but the individual is being subjected to it and knows it. The pain is the individual's. The pleasure is the universal substance getting its own way. So when a man feels that urge working in him, say at the point of ejaculation, he feels somehow that he's been taken advantage of by someone. And he was. The universal substance. The pain is his. The pleasure is the universal substance. If he participates in the pleasure of it at all, consciously, it must be because he says, I'm doing a universal job. And he is, at that level. Now, in that diagram you can see the whole mode of conscious evolution. You know that you have gross urges. You say you'll have your dinner one day very happily, and another day you won't feel like it. Right, so you've got an urge to get your dinner in. Then feel just why that urge is there now. Say, well, I'll have it in 5 minutes. Or 10. If you said this to the average man in an office who's used to having lunch at a certain hour, wait 10 minutes, immediately his digestive juices go whoosh, and he gets terrible indigestion, because he's a machine, a digestive machine. And if you say wait a minute, he will feel awful, and all funny kinds of processes will arrive here in this part, and around here on the solar plexus he'll become very perturbed, and he'll think he's going to lose the whole world. And then he'll begin to get annoyed with you. And the comfort mechanism in the average person is so strong that rather than admit that he is a slave to such a rhythm, pseudo-reasons are fabricated and send energies up here looking for little ideas to support why he should be regular. All those are mechanical processes. If you want to find out just who you are, you must break such things if it's only about 5 minutes. Because in that process of breaking the rhythm, you can feel what you're up against. When you've broken down the relation between feeling and urge by not allowing an urge to operate for a few minutes, then go up here and take your feeling and try to feel what an idea signifies in terms of liking and disliking. Every idea that you have, you like it or you dislike it, in its totality and in its parts. And the amount of liking and disliking is entirely a mathematical problem. If it's a complex idea, every element in it you must say either yes or no to. There may be 15 yeses and 25 no's, and you'll be slightly ambiguous, so I don't really much care for that one. But if you analyse it down to its fundamental elements, you will say yes, yes, no, no to different parts. So that when you're feeling I like and I dislike particular ideas, you are creating this center. You can't create it any other way than by feeling why you like ideas and dislike them, and breaking the idea down to get down to the fundamental liking and disliking. When you've got those two functioning, then you can really turn back on this and see for what it is,
a universal substantial reproductive energy coming through the individual organism to make more seeds. Don't try at that level to chop it, because you can't at that level. But just see that there is definitely a non-individual tendency. You can see why, because everybody's got it. So it isn't merely individual. It's a universal thing. It isn't clever. Everybody does it. And then you go up to this end and look at the individual idea and the absolute idea. And when this one becomes clarified, this one becomes more under control spontaneously. You can never control that one on its own field. Because when you put your mind down there, the whole of your energy slips down the body, goes into the substance and increases the seed output. When you go up here and consider the idea, the same energy there is translated up here, changes frequency, and becomes the supreme organ of thought of ideas related to the absolute. So there is your process. First, be quite sure that you know what a gross urge is, and then about what an idea is, like a triangle, a square, and a particular idea, like a chair, a telephone, and so on. Then go back and see if you can feel your urge, then see if you can feel your idea, until you can really do those things consciously. Then go back onto the sexual one, so that when it operates, which it will, in little tendencies on being, when it operates, just say, yes, it is not mine, it is something working through me. And make yourself quite sure that it isn't yours as an individual, it is something working through you. And make no attempt to control it from the individual end, because if you do, you'll get reactions that will surprise you. All you'll do is feed more energy that was up here into the substance and increase seed output. What you do is, when you become quite aware that is so, you just say, it is so. Then you go back up here and look at the individuated idea and the absolute, and try to see all the individuals as particularizations of the absolute idea. And gradually the energy will stop going into the substance and build up here this spiritual awareness. The energy then drifts slowly up here. Never try to force it from the individual end, because if you do, it will hit back at you much harder than you could possibly imagine. Because you're dealing there with the force down here which is justified by this one. This one precipitates this one and jams man between the two to force him to evolve onto reflexive self-conscious level. And it can only do it by increasing seed output until an organism is created which becomes aware of the problem. When the organism exists which is aware of the problem, then the energy can begin to rise up, and will do so spontaneously without individual effort. So there's a seven brain being for you. Go back to the three. Realize that the mechanical part of thinking here, the messages in the five senses, can't help you to escape from the external world, because it's fed always from the external world. The only thing that helps you to escape that is the consideration of the bait influences, the introvert ideas derived from the absolute vibration in the upper part of the mind. If you put the consciousness high up in the brain generally, there, and when commanding, you sense it between the eyebrows, but you keep it high, so the lowest point of it is between your eyebrows, you will find that this gradually here forms an awareness, even over the head. At certain levels of it, you'll actually find if you put your hand there, there is an aura of heat all around the head. That can vibrate to the point of becoming visual and make one of those lovely saint's halos. It becomes quite visible and flashes about if it's startling. Before then, it becomes very, very hot. Not subjectively, objectively. There's a real heat over there that any other person can come, put their hand in it, and they will feel that heat.
Okay.
Thank you for that. Good night.
Good night. Essential logic
of it is
very interesting. It's funny how the whole thing develops out of the Logos concept.
Yes.
Quite spontaneously. So that there's no effort required. Once the concept is there, it works. And you have to let it work. The moment you start from the five sense end with sense data and dictate to that master concept, it shuts up. You won't have anything to do with external dictatorships. So yeah. It just stops.
Yeah.
And if you allow it, it just flows out and makes a pure exposition of its own function. It does it in any brain where the five sense contribution is suspended. The relation between your feeling and your urge and universal urge, the relationship between your thought and feeling, and your feeling and universal thought. It's always this feeling that's got to be shifted about. As soon as you get the feeling and go like that, you find a limit existent. That's a definition. If you refine your feeling, it slips out and you find another definition. The sphere is one within the other. They have definite edges, and those edges can only be found by feeling. That's the meaning of the Taoist statement. If you can be a man, that means a counter, and yet remain a woman, that means a feeler. So you have to extend your feeling all the time, and yet be clear enough, not vaguely feeling, clear enough to know what you felt. And when you can verbalize what you felt, then you're a man-woman. That's the divine undergain. And then you're entitled to wear the badge of mercury on your lapel. Thank you.